From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour was made with a letter from a mother to her daughter. It begins, quote, "I write to you on your 13th birthday, one I'm sad to miss. There is work in the world that I've been called to do, mija, and the time has come for me to do it. I believe in my heart that I've given you and your brother all the wisdom that I, as a mother, can impart, because 13, Olga, is a magical age. Yes, you leave girlhood behind, but now you get to decide, day by day, what kind of woman you want to become." End quote. Olga is Olga Acevedo, and readers who come to know her in the book Olga Dies Dreaming may say that she struggled for most of her life to decide what kind of woman she wanted to become. The path is not an easy one. After the death of her father and the abandonment of her politically radical mother, Olga and her much-admired congressman brother must navigate various storms, family secrets and dramas, political corruption and strife, what happens when those inner issues intersect, and for themselves deciding what success actually is. Olga Dies Dreaming is the debut novel of Xochitl Gonzalez. It's also this year's choice for Rochester Reads, the annual citywide event through Writers and Books, where all of Rochester, really, and beyond, is invited to read the same book. This hour, we talk with Gonzalez about her book, as well as members of the Writers and Books team joining us, talking about how you can participate in this week's events. I'd like to welcome our guests, and it's great to have the author on the line with us, Xochitl Gonzalez, author of Olga Dies Dreaming. Xochitl, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's such an honor to be the Rochester Read Selection, so I'm really appreciative of this time.
Chris Fanning, Deputy Director of Writers and Books. Great to have you back. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
This is one of my favorite events that has been this way for many, many years. It's a great event. Angelique Stevens with us, a writer and member of the Artistic Advisory Committee for Writers and Books. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
And Chris Fanning, you know, one book a year, Rochester Reads. If all of Rochester read the same
That's
book.
All we're asking.
That's
just
it.
One book. No,
one...
we want you to read as much as possible.
Yeah,
you but this one, you know, we really hope you
Good
come out
gracious.
And read.
You should be reading more than one book. But
one book a month, at least.
But why don't you tell listeners, Chris, what is happening tomorrow?
Absolutely. So Rochester Reads is our flagship program at Writers and Books. And tomorrow will be our keynote event. So we're looking forward to having you here in Rochester. Xochitl. And tomorrow evening, we've got a little reception happening at the Strong Museum of Play from 5:30 to 6:45 that you can still buy tickets for. And then from 7 to 9, we have our keynote speech and book signing that you can also get tickets at wab.org.
Let me also promise the listeners I'm going to do my best with something here. So recently we had a former executive director of Writers and Books,
yeah,
Kyle Semmel, on the program talking about his debut novel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a listener told me that I gave away too much of the novel. And I just want you to know, I don't think I did. I actually don't even think I really did that. But I want to tell you that we try to have really thoughtful conversations about themes, big themes, author intentions, interpretations of characters and plot, without giving away everything. I'm not going to deprive you of the joy of reading great literature. I'm going to try anyway. But we got to talk about some of the books. And let me ask Angelique Stevens, you know, one book, this is it. Why was this book at the top of the list?
You know, first I have to say that I met Xochitl at Breadloaf in 2018, was it, Xochitl?
Yes.
And so I knew that I was going to read this book when it came out, and it took me a while to pick it up. And once I did, it was crazy. I think I finished it at 3 a.m. in the morning, and I had that kind of grief that you get, you know, when you finish a book. And I feel like I was in some serious tears at that moment. And it was just so overwhelming. And, you know, you want to get back into something so quickly because you left it. It was so good. But you know that nothing can be as good as that experience you had when you finished it. And I think I remember I sent you a text. It was like late, late in the morning, and it was just a black picture. But, you know, there's something about the character of Olga that I could relate to her. She's successful. She's independent. And she doesn't take anything from anybody. And, you know, I feel like I grew up in the 80s. I'm a Gen X kid. And, you know, I was brought up by pop culture. All the TV shows and the movies. And you know, there's this point where you're watching, you're absorbing pop culture, and you're like, no, that character wouldn't do that. Why do they have to make them like that? Mm-hmm. No, why? You know, you love the overall theme or the plot or the story, but there's always something that you want to change. And I had this visceral experience, Sochil, while I was reading Olga, that I didn't want to change anything about her. That she, you know, she was a strong, independent woman. She, you know, she was living her life, and nothing. Like, I was thinking this throughout the whole book as I was reading it. There was nothing I wanted to change about this woman.
What an endorsement, Sochil. What do you think?
I mean, it's like, it's very overwhelming. Like, since this book's come out, this kind of relationship people have had to Olga is, like, somewhat overwhelming, but also really, really beautiful, because the inspiration to write the book was that I just hadn't seen a woman like me, but also therefore like a lot of other women that I'd known on the page. And, you know, where they have a lot of agency, but they're still dealing with adversity, and that they're carrying so much with them that they've already come through. Right. Like, and just to really put, and with some humor, right? Like some, like there's some humor about the world and how crazy the world can be. And so when I, you know, when I hear women that I admire, like Angelique, say things like that, it's amazing. But also when I talk to younger readers and like they feel like this is like a big sister they'd not seen in a book before, it really does mean kind of a lot. Like that, it's been sort of, it's been transformative, honestly, for like my personal worldview. And so I'm always just really excited to connect with younger readers, because I started, the other part about it was like, I remembered reading The House on Mango Street and really connecting with Esperanza. But she was like a little kid, you know, in the book, she's like a preteen, you know, and then I'm like, what happened to Esperanza? And I always felt like Olga was kind of like meeting Esperanza in middle age in some iteration.
Well, if you want to have the kind of experience that Angelique is talking about, where you're up till 3 a.m. reading, and you want to try to squeeze it in before tomorrow, Chris Fanning, tell people where can they get Olga's Dies Dreaming?
Oh, you can get copies. The Rochester Library System has them in stock, both in print and through Libby. You can also get them through Writers and Books at Ampersand, both online and through our bookstore.
And yes, of course, if you have to support the Bezos family and everybody associated with Amazon, you can find it there, of course.
Noted. But I did not say that.
What I'm here to say is there's almost always a better option than Amazon. And it's typically small and local, but that's also another option. Mm-hmm. So Olga is, Olga is many things, but Olga's a wedding planner. And Sochil, you yourself have been a wedding planner, and you've said that in Olga, you wanted to kind of create a version of yourself, but without the therapy, which I thought was, which I thought was both funny, but interesting. Tell me more about the creation of this character.
Well, first, I really didn't want her to be a wedding planner because I wanted to feel like I was a fiction writer, and I felt like it was a cheat. But it just was such a like seeking ground to talk about class and the way in which you view and you view and value labor, I think, when you work as a wedding planner, because on the one hand, it looks like a white collar job. And on the other hand, it's actually remarkably blue collar. And you relate, you're dependent and interdependent on people with all different sorts of skill sets. And I just like, I can't walk away from that, you know, but the other true thing was that my mom was a political activist and did leave me with my grandparents, but I was only 3. And I wanted this character to have the freedom of being angry. So I had her get left like at an age where, you know, I also grew up in the 80s and then into the 90s when New York was very rough and tumble. And it was like, you were tough at 13, you know, so I was like, I wanted her to be kind of like a feral Brooklyn 13-year-old that gets left so that she'd be like a little bit more mad. And the under-therapizedness was like, how does that then manifest itself in her life? And when we first meet her, it's like through a lot of peccadilloes, right? Like she's like stealing napkins from from her rich clients to give to her, like, you know, working class cousin for her wedding. Like, you know, like it's like she sort of like has these little transgressions that these baby moral transgressions that she kind of rationalizes. They're like baby acts of revenge for this anger that she carries with her. And I just thought that, you know, I didn't see a lot of women that are allowed to be angry too often. We're not allowed to be angry that often, so I wanted her to have a baby rage, you know?
I love that about Olga. You know, she's this sort of complex character responding to those issues in such real ways. You know, the identity, the complexity between personal success and social responsibility, the individual versus the community, poverty and wealth, all of those things are so beautifully juxtaposed in your book.
Thank you so much. I think it was like, I think that's the other thing too, is like sometimes we get characters and we move them through a world. You can see people get moved through a world that is a problematic world, but I wanted her to be very aware of the problems. Right? Mm-hmm. I think that having a mom that was an activist and knowing that she was always made aware of the problems of society is like she can't exist and relax in her own brain. Like nothing is just like a pipe is never just a pipe for poor Olga. Like, right. And that to me felt really like important, you know, like it's like, she's like, it's not just that I have access to these napkins. She's like completely aware cognitively why her cousin Mabel maybe didn't have access to the kind of people that have these napkins. She's a little tormented in the beginning. And I think a lot of the book is a journey to some kind of a peace.
I love it that it's just napkins too. It's just such a small, it's such a small thing. And yet there's so much meaning in that.
Well, as a brief aside, the kinds of monster clients that Olga has to deal with are actually kind of true to life, aren't they, Sochi? I mean, the kind of client who freaks out if it's the wrong kind of rose that might lead to a lawsuit. Those are real things, right?
That was like Law and Order ripped from the headlines of real wedding planning stories, right? Like, it's like, I think one of the things once I was gone from that industry that I realized was like a temperature dialing down was like, I just walked around much less worried about personal litigation. And I think I hadn't thought about how much stress I carried on a constant basis, because like, it was very common to just say, look, nobody wants to get sued, right? Like as you're setting up for a party, which is sort of insane, but
it's
an honest, yeah, it's pretty horrible, right? Like it's like, and these are businesses like that, you know, really a lot of the time we're like, acts of passion because people want to do something creative to earn a living, right? And like they're eking out like mild profit margins. So, you know, the idea that this sort of hovers over is real. And I think it was partly why I was like, it's just too good to walk away from. Like I was like, I have to like bring this to light, not in terms of just like, oh, rich people being bad, but like, what are the consequences of living it and, you know, living with it, right?
Well, and on the subject of what it means to be successful, which is literally a question for every human being as they get older and they start thinking about what they want. By many measures, we meet Olga and her brother Prieto when they are doing well by American standards or by living in Brooklyn or New York City standards. Prieto is a congressman. Olga is, yeah, I mean, there are certainly, as you say, class dynamics to Olga's work, but she's successful in her business.
Yeah.
But their relative career success does paper over some of their struggle with their family issues, Prieto some other things, I mean, Olga some other things. What does it mean, Sochi? Let me ask you that at this point in your life, how do you define success for yourself?
Yeah, you know, that's such a great question. Because when I first started writing this, I really was thinking in a very particular way about the sort of push and pull, particularly amongst Latino families, for like everything that it requires for you to be able to like be successful by kind of just American standards is like time at work. And that therefore that renders you kind of a failure to your family. Like they're like, you're never here. And like they're at odds with each other. And I think that for me now, like, and now it's sort of interesting to watch over the last like, you know, years since I started working on this to now, how that's sort of become like the question that I think a lot of us have like across like ethnic and racial boundaries is like, wait, what are we doing all this for? Right. And I think for me, like success is just enough the security to then be able to enjoy and take the time with the people that I really love. And I think that once you get to the point where you've tipped that tipping point and you like are like, I don't even know the last time I spent time with the people that mean the most to me, I don't know that that's actually successful. It just might be earning a lot or getting recognized or getting, you know, taking time and needing attention. And so I sort of have a very sensitive barometer. And once I get to the point where I'm like, I don't remember the last time I was surrounded by loved ones, mm-hmm. like in that feeling of it, then I start to reevaluate. And I think I'm on a constant process of reevaluating, like, right? Like, am I leading what I think of as a successful life? Because it can be very easy to get caught up or to overstay yes or to like do all those things. And then the next thing you know, who is the life for, right?
Well, I mean, I love this line about Olga's rich clients. Quote, simply existing seemed an immense burden to them, end quote. Yeah. And there is all kinds of research about happiness, about what people need to be happy and as it pertains to wealth. And so a lot of the research, and I may be a little outdated, but a lot of the research indicates that there is a diminishing returns level to happiness, and it comes at much less income than the average person would guess. Now it's now it's like barely into the six figures, and that's a lot. I mean, I'm not saying that's not a lot of money, but I'm saying that it's not $1 million. It's not $10 million a year. And in fact, the more you make, you're not actually happier, and there can be this kind of burden that you write about with Olga's rich clients. And so the book in some ways seems to be this rumination on a very American obsession with wealth accumulation. Am I reading that correctly?
Oh, no, totally. And I think she, in her fears, in her personal fears of being seen as like less than, she wants, you know, she's like into the markers, right? Like the handbag and like all the things. And then that, like, but the earning of that or what it takes to earn that all takes away from the stuff that actually makes her happy. So it's like, it ends up being a bit of a cycle too, right? Like, it's like, the status items require more money and more work and more labor and more distancing from yourself. And then those are the same things that, like, you think temporarily make you happy. So, yes, I really did want to kind of question all of that. And I think, like, you know, what is the notion of American success and how can you live around that?
And, I think so much of that has to do with the individualism, this very American, meritocracy, this idea of the individual having to make or break their lives. And in... and losing the communal in that process.
Yeah. Well, and actually just one last thing about it is like the title of the book is taken from the Pedro Preti poem, Puerto Rican Obituary, which I think the Poetry Foundation has the whole thing online for, you know, that anybody can access. But the poem is really about like the largest of migration from the island to New York, how like the Puerto Rican community kind of lost itself chasing material things, right? And so the Olga in the poem, he follows kind of five fictional Puerto Rican characters, and the Olga in the poem dies dreaming of diamonds, and that's Olga dies dreaming of diamonds, and then they're like cubic zirconias, you know, like it's like so a lot of it is about, you know, how you pull it, like chasing these things pulls you away from the people that accept you as you are. And I referenced the poem a couple of times in the book, but like it was like kind of one of those things where I already kind of was on Olga's journey, and then I reconnected with that poem, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is a reaffirmation of what this book is about. So that really was a big part of it.
Well, I mean, those questions are universal, and I really appreciated Maggie Shipstead's review of your book in the New York Times to the point where I want to read a little passage from this review, because I know listeners are going to think I'm hanging on to these questions about success, wealth accumulation, inequality, happiness. And I'm not saying, you know, if you made $1 million, you wouldn't be happier. Maybe you're the rare person who would just get incrementally happier with more money, because maybe you'd find really lovely ways to make other people's lives better. But it's when people think that they're only accumulating for themselves, and the more they accumulate, they're not actually happier. They're usually pretty miserable. Well, here's how Maggie Shipstead describes this particular theme. Quote, "What is the American dream these days anyway? The term, as coined in 1931 by James Truslow Adams, described an idealistic vision of the United States as a true meritocracy, where opportunity was equally available to all. 90 years and a whole lot of systemic racism and widening class division later, we have good reason to cast a more jaundiced eye on the concepts of opportunity and equality in this country, and given how even the bootstrappiest of billionaires can't seem to find satisfaction in any amount of hoarded wealth, it is worth wondering what exactly we're supposed to be dreaming of, end quote. That's beautiful prose in and of itself. What did you make of the review? I assume you read the New York Times review of your book. So, Gio, what did you think?
I actually didn't.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hey.
my agent told me that it wasn't really a rave and that I should avoid it.
I thought it was a lovely review.
So I didn't. I was like, it's hilarious that like they were really like combing through that to try to find a pull quote, but I really didn't read it. So.
That paragraph I just read loved your book. Okay. Listen, I'm not your agent. I don't have to do PR for you, Xochitl Gonzalez. Your book's doing just fine without me. We're talking to Xochitl Gonzalez, the author of Olga Dies Dreaming. That is the novel chosen by Writers and Books for the Rochester Reads program. It is If All of Rochester Read the Same Book, and this is the selection for 2024. And I was about to say Olga's going to be here tomorrow. It's actually Xochitl is going to be here tomorrow. Olga can be with you at any point. The
Olga
book's available.
Is my name for Starbucks and coffee orders.
That's amazing. I love it.
I do love that. I think that is great. You can pick up the book at Ampersand at Writers and Books. You can pick up the book in a number of places. Chris Fanning?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, if you can't get to Ampersand, Rochester's a thriving community for indie bookstores. Please check out, you know, Hippocampo, Book Eater, Kimbo, all the other ones I'm forgetting. There's no shortage of opportunities to get books locally here in Rochester.
Also, a lot of these places are just really cool spaces
yes.
to hang out.
Yes.
Really. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. We've been talking about sort of the success and the wealth without giving away too much of the plot. Thank you very much, listeners. But let me also say there's also the idea of fame here. And for Olga, a kind of flop into a foray into the world of fame. Olga's venture into reality TV turns sour when, the producers want to play up or she might say exploit her Latina heritage. And so, Chio, I wonder if this is your commentary on the way that, number one, cultures might struggle on their own to find identity in new physical spaces where there's a lot of assumptions or demands for assimilation, while the powerful forces of society are reducing culture into stereotypes for easy sort of clicks or bucks. You want to talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think, there's a lot in both Olga's story and in Prieto's story about like performance and kind of the need to perform. And so I did, it was meant to be a commentary about that was mildly satirized, but then not quite, like, because I really was asked to do a TV pilot for a show called Spice It Up. So there really is sort of a, rather than, I think because we have general diversity challenges, particularly the entertainment industry, and the media industry is
the publishing industry.
And the publishing industry, like it's the way in which we are encouraged to present ourselves is often in the shorthand that feels accurate to somebody from outside of the experience, right? And so with that sort of like kind of place, you kind of see the way that, Olga is like, well, you need recognition in order to like find more monetary success, right? I think at one point she calls fame a proxy for wealth. I forgot the exact phrasing, but like, so she decides to do it. But then when she is actually living the experience of performing their version of who she's supposed to be, like it's like nauseating. She actually can't go through with it. Like it's like she really hears, like she does. She's like kind of sick to her stomach about the whole thing, and she can hear her parents' judgment in her mind. So I think though that that's not it's not an like a completely fictional like description of what so often happens. There was it didn't get picked up, but when we were shooting the pilot for Hulu, there was like a scene that wasn't in the book that I wrote for the TV experience, which was like Mabel's like bridal shower. And we had like seven Latina women, like ranging, like from, of all kind of races and ethnicities and ethnic backgrounds. But they're all Latinas. And one character started to cry because she was like, I've been an actress for 30 years and I've never been in a scene where every character was Latina and had a college degree until right now.
Wow.
And even though there's 3.5 million Latinas as of like 2 years ago with college degrees, right? So like, but we get like flattened to service workers or this, that. And then even in that sense, Olga has this chance at having a show, being this hyper Latin person, but she's still the help. right? Mm-hmm. Like, and so I think there was a lot of accurate, I didn't know. It was like, it felt like foreshadowing, because then I ended up going in more deeper into entertainment, and I was like, oh, this is really, really accurate. Mm-hmm. So I was like, really like fights about like, that doesn't feel Latin to us. And it's like, wait, but there's nobody Latino in the room, you know? So I do think that that's a big part of it, is like, how do you have to play a version of who people think you are. And then with that, though, without giving away too much, that's true for other reasons, right? Like, but so in some funny way, I think a lot of their journey is sort of throwing off both who their mom wants them to be and that they try to act like, and also who society wants them to be, and kind of claiming their own space on their own terms.
Well, Angelique, when we were talking about different industries affected in these ways, you jumped in there with publishing. Did you want to add to some of your feelings there?
Well, I can't tell you the numbers. Maybe Socio can, but the publishing industry is the same way. There's been a problem with representation in all parts of publishing, from all the top down.
I believe it's like 95% of published books in a year are by white authors only. And so that means 5% are by like every other kind of underrepresented group within that, right? So it's like less than, I know it's way less than 7% of like, and that's including adult books, because like actually we do a little bit better. Latino authors do better with like children and YA, but like with adult fiction, it like plummets down. And so it's really, really bleak. Like and it's particularly it's also a problem on the editorial side, on the staffing side, as well as on the publishing side. So in some ways, I always feel like this book was a bit of a miracle.
It is. So, and you know, the publishing industry in the last couple of years has done a ton to increase diversity. And then more recently, it's sort of losing, it's lost that momentum by losing some of those people.
We're talking to Xochitl Gonzalez, author of Olga Dies Dreaming. And Olga, Xochitl, I'm not going to call you Olga again, I promise. This book is not a memoir. Olga is a fictional character. But Xochitl will be here for a chance for listeners to not only read the book, but interact. And so, Chris Fanning, briefly, you want to jump in one time here with what's going on tomorrow?
Yep, we'd love for you to join us tomorrow night at the Strong Museum of Play. We've got a reception happening from 5:30 to 6:45. And then you can meet the author at her keynote address starting at 7 p.m. With a book signing following that. We'd love to have you. And all the ticketing information's at wab.org. And we're also streaming this. So if you can't join us in person, please join us online.
Really just wonderful events throughout the years. Such an awesome community-wide event here. Xochitl, a listener, Dom wanted to know, if the book takes a stance on Puerto Rican statehood, what would you say to Dom?
Oh, I think it absolutely does, to the point that I've made some enemies. I was raised in a pretty pro-independence household, and I think I try to lay out both cases, but ultimately I'd say it leans far more into like actually independence than even statehood, and probably like, you know, I mean, this is such a complicated question, like I love talking about it with people that really know, but you know, there's sort of an associated independent territory status that's probably the most like viable if we were to ever get there. But yeah, I do take a stand, and I think and it lays out kind of a bunch of the cases that, you know, on both sides of statehood versus independence versus certainly the status quo. It probably says no pretty strongly to the status quo.
But I think this is where this is one area where you as a novelist deserve credit for not essentializing the character of Blanca, not creating this sort of angelic, perfect character fighting against these oppressive, colonializing forces. That would be sort of a one-dimensional, not layered or not interesting character. And instead, I want to talk about Olga's mother, Blanca. She is mostly out of her adult kids' lives, having left them, as you said, when Olga was 13. Blanca is a revolutionary. She sees her Puerto Rico as having been essentially exploited and abused by now the United States government that her son is a member of Congress for. And yeah. her two children, Prieto and Olga, despite, you know, having, you could argue that they should be angry with her or have these complicated emotions, but they still kind of have these very complex, I don't know if you would say a desire for her approval, but I wonder, let's start with this. Why can't they let her go? And how would you describe that dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, I think that she's deeply influential to them, on them and in their lives, right? And I think that they have slightly differing takes on it. And that was one of the things that was really fun about, I don't have a sibling, so it was really fun to give her a sibling and looking at like how something happening to you when you're 13 versus 16 sort of shifts the way that you see it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And she kind of acts, she's a rebel. Like Olga's a rebel. Like it's like if my mom wants me to be this type of person, like I'm out of here. But I always imagine the soundtrack of her mom's values, her parents' values running in her head, even when she's sort of like transgressing those values. Her brother, on the other hand, I think really is hoping to like, you know, I think at one point I quote him as saying he feels like it's the family business, right? And he's found his way to be in the family business, which is being a politician, which is his mom might actually argue otherwise. But I think that in general, you know, I was estranged from my mom. My mom was not around. I was raised by her parents. And I always thought as I got into adulthood, the thing that was so fascinating was how people would assume that there was something wrong with you if you didn't talk to your parent. And instead of it being like I think every kid would talk to their parent no matter what. Like it's like you see children that are just like deeply abused and they still like will be loyal to their parents, you know? And I wanted to kind of explore this sort of unresolved notion of like abandonment, right? And like, and how it's hard to ever quit that person. And it's interesting because like in the letter, her mom is like, I think I've given you everything I can, right? And it was also meant to be a little bit of like a look at women of a certain age, you know, like whenever I get to talk about this book with like boomer women, like they're always like, go Blanca. And when I talk to like Gen Zs, they're like, the mom is terrible. like they're like, they think Blanca is like, you know, just like so amazing. And like, you know, that she took charge of her life, but like, you know, because I think they know what it feels like to feel that the buffet has a limited number of options for you, right? As a woman at a certain time. So I really tried to like, I tried to sort of be true to how that impacted the kids, but really treat Blanca like a person that like a person that is, can love in a big way, but maybe not in a small way. And honestly, gave me a lot of insight and empathy for my mom that I hadn't had to sit there and write this as her and write this character as, you know, a person that, you know, would have, I took a lot of acting in high school. My acting teacher, Mr. Martin, would always say like, nobody wakes up and thinks they're a villain and twirls their mustache, right?
Yes.
And so I think that the point is like, she feels that she loves, if she can liberate this place, that is a form of love. She's creating a new space for her family, her kids. Like it's like in her mind, that is a form of love that's bigger and has more payoff.
I think there's also this thing about identity too, for a child who's living in this sort of liminal space as an identity that's on the margins. You know, living in a sort of dominant culture who, no matter what their parent is or where they've come from, they sort of understand that their parents are also, you know, affected by the larger cultural and political issues, and that in order to get closer to their own identity, they have to get closer to what their parents were and where their parents come from. And so, you know, it goes from the micro to the macro. There's the individual, and then there's the parents, and then there's the ancestry, and then there's the land, and all of those larger things that sort of play into who one becomes and who one is. And, you know, that's why children are, no matter who their parents are, they still want to listen to them.
It's so true.
Well, I mean, I'm Gen X, and I was mostly on the Gen Z side of this, mostly because of how Prieto is treated. You know,
so yeah.
Like we're not in forgivable territory for me.
yeah. No, totally.
You know, so let's chalk one up for Gen Z. No, I mean, like, listen, it is more complex than that, and that's why I think the way the readers are responding differently to this character is, I think, an endorsement of the complexity of the writing.
That's the beauty of
it. Yeah. Thank you so much. The other thing that I'll say that I think is so, like, was, like, felt important is that even when you aren't really around your parent, like, especially a mom, I think, like, they just sort of, they can still get things right. Like, right? Like, and I think that was part of, like, the letters is, like, some of those letters are very harsh, but they're not necessarily fully inaccurate, right? Like, mm-hmm. And I think that was, you know, just, like, my grandmother, like, would deeply frustrate me sometimes, and she would say, like, 7 things, and you're like, but why are 4 of them completely true? Like, 3 are, like, you have this whole wrong, and then it's, but 4 of them are, like, oh, my God, why do you know that? Like, it's, like, and I wanted to kind of have that in there.
Mm. It's terrible when someone that you detest is correct. No.
Yeah. No.
Yeah. By the way, what is the line on the twirling the mustache? Because I would like to borrow that in the future. Mm-hmm. Where did that come from?
Oh, it came from my high school acting teacher, Mr. Scott Martin, and I thought it's like a way. Talk about something that you hear it and it completely changes the way I walk through the world. To be completely honest. Like, it's like, what a garnerer of empathy. Like, it's like they have their motivations, and like their motivations may cause pain to you, but like those are motivations that live in their head, not to be like, it's like they're basically not, nobody's trying theoretically to be bad. They have some other motivation. So, right. And it's like, and I just found that to be a life altering way of seeing the world.
This is an ongoing theme on this program. And this just is probably a more clever way than the way I typically say it. And listeners have probably heard it a lot if you listen to this program with some regularity. We talk about politics. Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
I'm in the Molly Ivins camp that says that the vast majority of human beings on this planet, very few people are going to bed at night thinking, boy, I got away with something bad today. And I'm on the bad side, but I got away with it. You know, and so I never use the twirling the mustache thing, but I love that because that's a great visual for how we tend to think about
That's right.
Ideological opponents, people vote differently. People are not thinking they're bad, but they got away with it. They're thinking, they're more likely thinking that you're twirling your mustache.
Mm-hmm. And
you know,
that's right.
And it's important to remember that. I mean, I think that there's a few limits at the top of the power structure where people realize that they are doing terrible and hurtful things and they are gleeful in getting away with it. But
yeah,
I think that the average person is not.
The average person, yes.
Yeah. I think that's great. I did want to ask you, I'm going to try to ask this in a way that is not giving away too much of the plot, but I do want to try to ask this because I will confess, Sochil, that initially the Prieto plot line about his sexuality and about his struggle, not only for his career, but also parentally, you know, there's part of me that kind of was in that like, oh, like hasn't literature really tackled this a lot? But to the credit of the story, a lot of the if there's a stereotype of literature or character development, it may be a character is concerned about their sexuality, but concerned about coming out, concerned they will not be accepted, you know, holds back, and then feels love, feels accepted, feels, you know, all of a sudden all those guardrails come down. And it's not exactly what happens with Prieto, and it still ends up in a much better place. And so it turns a little bit of that expectation of that plot narrative on its head a little. That's how I see that particular plot line.
Oh, no, I appreciate it. I mean, I think it felt important to me, that plot line, because two things. You know, I was really, I've always been lucky, and I've had, you know, I'm in my late 40s, but I've always had friends that were a bit younger and, you know, and for different reasons. And I always thought it was interesting how people didn't realize how much has changed so fast, you know, like, mm-hmm. like within a lifetime about how much a culture has shifted, particularly around queer identity issues and liberty. And so I think that there, and then secondly, I think particularly in like the Caribbean and Latino community, there's still so much stigma.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really felt it was important to look at a man of, you know, of my generation and show, you know, like, I think at one point I walked through, like Jim McGreevy hadn't like come out yet. Right. And that was like a giant scandal in my adult lifetime. You know what I mean? Like, and I think,
and what was that, like 10, that, 12 years ago now? I mean, like, I'm trying to remember.
And Ellen was still closeted, right? Mm. Like Ellen DeGeneres was still closeted in my adult lifetime. Right. Like, and so I think that, we don't realize how much these big things kind of matter and help make people confident and make people safe. And also how even then after that, when you've been living in a place for so long, how difficult it can be to like, to feel like you can step out. And so I felt important to me to do that. But like, I think then I spent a lot of time thinking about like, you know, when I've talked to friends of mine that had been closeted, what had kept them there. And a lot of it was, there was a deep, again, there's so much communication that I think happens in our families that isn't verbal and that's sensory. And I think a lot of what kept him there is that he felt like his mom might not fully embrace it. And then he wasn't wrong. Like instinct, I think, always plays a big part in my characters' lives. And I think, and it felt important to be true to that.
Angelique, how did you feel about that particular plot line?
Well, I was just going to say about what you were saying is that there are social cues. I mean, even if there aren't explicit, there's no explicit language, there are still social cues, and you see them even now. So growing up in families and somebody says, you know, there's the central assumption, oh, have you met a girl yet? You know, those, they're so small. Those, they're just micro assumptions. And you may not even be able to name one as you're growing up, but they start to pile on each other. And even though this is the kind of topic that's been talked about and it's out there, it's still necessary. And I was just thinking this morning how your book touches on so much. I mean, you know, all of these social issues and how, you know, these years later, it's still just as present today and just as necessary today as it was.
Yeah.
You know, only 5 years ago, 7, 10.
Chris, anything you want to add on that one?
Only that I think for myself, in my experience in reading this book, I loved the message of, you know, ultimately showing up for ourselves and being true to ourselves while having grace with that too. So not forcing ourselves into situations, but navigating those in safe spaces and with support systems that we may not have taken full advantage of in the past, but have been there. So I think that all kind of comes into play in the novel, and I've really taken that with me. So thank you for that, Sochiel.
So, a few minutes left here. The book is Olga Dies Dreaming. Sochiel Gonzalez, the author, is with us. A debut novel. There's a couple things I want to ask you outside of the book. And we hadn't even mentioned, by the way, that there are, you know, you bring real world plot points into this story that every listener would be familiar with, Hurricane Maria. Frankly, some of the pain, what should be maybe embarrassment at a federal response, and you know what Blanca might say about that, how that might how that affected other characters. It's all there, but I did want to ask you before the time was up here. You know, a lot of listeners would love to at some point in their life say, "That's it, I'm doing it, I'm writing the book." And you know, you didn't publish 5 novels in your 20s. You know, this is so how did this finally happen for you? I say finally, like you and I are around the same age. We're like, boy, you know, wow, you know, it's the end of the line. And you know, at least we did it. You know, we're in our 40s. Like, come on.
But
there's nothing wrong with 40s. But I hope the question is clear enough. So chill for would be writers who haven't done it. You know, age doesn't really matter. I think you're a great example of that.
Yeah, I mean, I turned 40, and my grandmother, the last of my grandparents that raised me, passed away like maybe a month before my birthday, and And then for my birthday, I was meant to go down to Puerto Rico with friends, but then my birthday fell between Hurricane Irma and Hurricane Maria, and so we couldn't go. And I don't know if it was, you know, I could get overly spiritual about it, but the most straightforward is that somehow every fear that I kind of held, we were very working class, you know, very blue collar. Every fear that I held about, like, I couldn't do something after I always like to say it was her ghost, but like after her passing, I just didn't feel afraid anymore. And other people might feel like maybe it's just like midlife and you're like, it's time to do the thing. But like it felt less maybe midlife than it felt like all the things that used to whisper no, like suddenly it was like they were all whispering yes. And so I had remembered this program existed called Bread Loaf, and like, and maybe instead of trip I would have taken to like a beach, to Vermont where I met Angelique, and we spent, like 10 days on this mountain taking workshops. And I just suddenly was like, oh my God, like these are my people. Like their brains work the way my brain works, where it connects lots of different things. And you can do it at any age. That was what was also beautiful about going. Even more, I ended up getting my MFA, but even more than that, I'm glad that my first intro was a program like Bread Loaf, because it was like there were on ramps at lots of different ages and life points and entry points to having this life and this career that I think had I thought about just doing an MFA and I saw that everybody was in their 20s, I might have gotten intimidated, you know. And so it was great to meet people that were peers, that were older. Like, I remember the year that we were there, Angelique, there was an older gentleman who was doing poetry, and he was, like, with a walker and would walk, you know, like, he had a walker going into listening to readings. And I just thought to myself, oh, this truly is, like, the cradle to the grave kind of thing, you know. And I felt, like, I just felt so, like, emboldened by it. And then I really wanted to talk about a lot of these things that the book contains, that I felt like I almost couldn't get it off my chest fast enough. I was so upset about the way in which, you know, the media and news can put highlight something going on, but they can't humanize it the way that art can. Mm-hmm. And I just felt that I wanted to make art about the things that were distressing me. And so it just kind of came together.
So Chiel, after that year that we were at Bread Loaf, there were about, I think there were like five people almost in the space of a month who sold their books. You, Aclavis, Daphne Pelosi, Andreatis. Mm-hmm. And then you had that panel at AWP a couple years later, a debut authors panel. And I showed up late because it was early in the morning. And the place was packed, like out the door. People were in this panel. And I was standing, you know, in the back, and people were in front, and I was watching several people in that row as they're listening to you Google you, and then buy your book. It was,
oh my
God, that to me that was amazing. That was an amazing time.
Wow.
And it just was a testament to the power of all the magic that happened on Bread Loaf.
So,
truly.
So let's inspire would-be writers with a couple of things here. First of all, so Chiel, what are you working on next?
I'm working on another novel, and I'll say that the character of Mateo is a smaller role in this book, but it takes place 10 years before Olga does. It's not a prequel per se, because Olga's not in it, but Mateo's earlier life is part of this next book, and it's sort of a gender swapped retelling of The Great Gatsby set in Fort Greene before the financial crisis. So, I'm excited.
What's the timeline for that?
I have to turn it in. I have to turn it in like at the beginning, early in the year next year. So I'm about to hibernate. Now, once Hispanic Heritage Month is over, I'm about to go and hibernate and just really work on this book, which I'm excited about. It's like I sort of see that book and my second book and Olga as a bit of a what I think of as a Brooklyn girl trilogy. So I'm excited.
And listeners might with some regularity see your byline in The Atlantic. How often?
Oh, they're very good, and they let the things take as long as they need to take. But I just had a piece come out this weekend about Sandra Cisneros.
That was gorgeous. That piece was gorgeous.
Thank you. About loose women. And then there's keep your eyes out because I've got something about rich sex kink coming up soon.
Right on.
Rich sex kink in the Atlantic.
Amazing.
Okay. And Angelique, what's your next project?
I'm also working on a book that's coming out in 2026. And it's about the bootstrapping myth and, you know, growing up poverty and here in Rochester.
Mm-hmm. 2026 for that.
Yep. And the lie of the American dream.
Well, it has been an invigorating hour. Xochitl Gonzalez, we will see you in Rochester tomorrow.
Yes. So excited. Thank you so much for having me on. And thank you so much for welcoming me to Rochester.
Chris Fanning, Deputy Director of Writers and Books. For listeners who popped in late, they're going to meet Xochitl where and when tomorrow?
Tomorrow night, the Strong Museum of Play, WAB.org. You can come to our reception, 5:30 to 6:45. Or please join us for Xochitl's keynote address at 7 o'clock, followed by a book signing, and it'll also be online.
And the 7 o'clock keynote is where?
At the Strong Museum.
At the Strong Museum. Okay, WAB.org. All the information is there. Chris Fanning and the team do such outstanding work, and we really appreciate them pulling together this event for our listeners every year. Thank you, Chris Fanning.
Thank you for having us.
Just lovely. Angelique Stevens, writer and member of the Artistic Advisory Committee for Writers and Books, and an author herself. Great to have you here. Thank you for being here. Xochitl Gonzalez, author of Olga Dies Dreaming, book number one. It will not be the last. Congratulations, Xochitl. Thanks for making time.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
More connections coming up in a moment.